Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have an empowering era ahead. We're going to talk about all the scientific papers linking refined white sugar to chronic disease, and there are a lot of them. We're going to talk about the benefits of citrus, what is called limonene. It is a glucoside. What does that mean? It means that citrus, like lemons, have a chemical in it that decreases inflammation in the body by 40%. We'll deal with that. Most physicians in Asia withhold life-sustaining treatments for the terminally ill. Why? Well, the National University Hospital of Singapore has done the survey, and they've come up with why, and I'll share that. 100 million Americans live with chronic pain, but they don't have treatments at work. We'll deal with that and more. Also today, a special commentary from Dar Jamil from Truth Out, The Methane Monster Roars. U.S. or U2 and Bono, celebrity partners with Monsanto and the G8 nations to bio-wreck African farms with GMOs. That's not good, but they're getting away with it. Greenland's melt is really bad. You remember I mentioned many times that we are in chaos theory and no one can accurately predict when large amounts of water will start to pour into the ocean, raising it from Antarctica and Greenland? It's happening. Losing the climate fight, has 400 parts per million become the planet's new norm? Deidre Fulton from Common Dreams. And former pro-GMO scientist speaks out on the real dangers of genetically engineered food. Someone from the inside is talking to us. My guest in the second part of our program will be Professor David Ray Griffin on the topic of, can civilization survive the fossil fuel crisis, the moral and spiritual issues humans must face for humanity to survive. He is Professor Emeritus of the philosophy of religion and a specialist in process theology. And he's published over 30 books, and he is really a remarkable mind. You won't want to miss that. Let's begin. Years ago, over 35 years ago, I did a debate on NBC Network with Dr. Elizabeth Whalen, and she's a good debater. She's a strong advocate for what she believes in. But, of course, she and I differ because she believes in sugar and I don't. And I'm a vegan and she's not. In any case, it was a lively debate. And it was about sugar. And I had taken several articles, over 16 articles, from the peer-reviewed literature showing the dangers of sugars. I even got articles from the British Medical Journal from back at the beginning of the century, around 1900 to 1906, showing at that time they were concerned about sugar-related illnesses and the average consumption was only 6 pounds per year. Now it's over 150 pounds per year. So I have been updating an article for decades. Every month or two I show the newest science. This is the newest science. Ready for these numbers? A team of scientists in the University of California in San Francisco recently pored through more than 8,000, I repeat, 8,000 scientific papers on how sugar affects the body and came to the conclusion that it not only makes people fat, but also it makes them sick. The project, which was dubbed Sugar Science, exposes sugar as a primary culprit in the formation of metabolic disease, which can lead, as we know, to heart disease and type 2 diabetes. The lead scientist, Laura Schmidt, of the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, she's a professor, and her team said that these findings are comprehensive. Sugar is highly toxic to the body and vital organs, including the liver. So, finally, for all those who support the sugar industry and those who say, gee whiz, can't be that bad, yes, it is bad. And it's bad to the bone, and it causes disease and death from those diseases. Now, something good is bean. The bean is a good food. It's a good source of protein and fiber and B vitamins and polynutrients. Now, this is the latest on the good bean. 5 beans that can reduce your risk of cancer. And this is based upon good science. And this was research that was done over 41 countries. And they found that eating beans reduced the incidence of death from breast cancer, prostate cancer, and colon cancer. So what are the things we should know? First, eating beans can stop breast cancer. There's a major study. It's been going on for decades. It's called the Nurses' Health Study 2. It's among the largest and longest-running investigations of factors influencing women's health. And what they did is they look at the flavanol-rich foods that were protective of the breast tissue in premenopausal women, ages 26 to 46. And what they found was that of all the things that could help a woman, beans and lentils were protective at a major level. So others were helpful, but not against cancer. Teas, onions, apples, string beans, broccoli, green peppers, and blueberries, all good, but it didn't prevent breast cancer, but the beans did, and that's important. Another study, the Four Corners Breast Cancer Study from Natural News, was unique because it was focused on Hispanics and Native Americans. And what they found was that the more beans consumed, the less risk of breast cancer. Then men can benefit from frequent bean eating also. They found that when they looked at 3,313 men who were followed for 12.6 years, they found that the eating of beans reduced the risk of prostate cancer by almost 50%. Wow, that's a big reduction. They also found that beans stop renal, gastric, and colon cancer. And they're really good in antioxidants. They have a lot of superstar antioxidants in there as well. So pinto, kidney, lima bean, pink bean, black beans, soy beans, red beans, those are all terrific. Make sure you get them on a regular basis. I once worked for a short period of time with a woman who came to see me one Saturday. She was 90 when she came into the office. I had not met her, didn't know she existed, but she was the wife of the great nutritionist and advocate at the beginning of the century, Bernard McFadden. Her name was Johnny Lee McFadden. And she said that she had some first edition signed books from her husband that she wanted to give me. She said, "You're the new Bernard McFadden, except you're 25, and he was 85 when he jumped out of an airplane to celebrate his birthday and landed in water, and they took him in the hospital, and he was fine. And then they injected him with something, and it killed him. He'd still be alive today," she said. And that began an interesting friendship. And one day she took me with a bunch of nurses, old nurses. I'm talking about people in their 80s and 90s that used to work with her husband and her upstate to Livingston Manor, because there on top of a beautiful hill looking out over the valley that's above Liberty and Monticello, you have a long vista that you can see. They had a healing clinic, and she told me what they did every day. And she had photographs from the 1940s and 50s. People would do sunbathing. That was big. No matter what time of year, they had to get out and be vigorous and do all kinds of exercises and drink green juices and drink sauerkraut juice. But they also every day had to have 3 glasses of lemon juice. She said it was bitter because he used a whole lemon because it was a protocol from Europe. And she said, Gary, she said, you can't imagine how healthy people were when they had been there for a month and came home. But we detoxified them. They got massage and colonics. So this was a long time ago. They were really holistic. And so I thought about that at the time. And I started putting more lemons, the whole lemon, and the whole grapefruit, meaning the skin, the pulp, and the seeds, when I would juice it. Now, here's a study from the Journal of Functional Foods, a major journal. And what they have found, this is from scientists at the Agriculture Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the University of California, Davis, quote, antioxidants, carotenoids, polyphenols, all important, cancer risk reduction, cardiovascular health, healthy aging, turning off inflammation, all of these can be dealt with beneficially by a citrus extract called limonene. It is a glucoside, and it decreases the markers for inflammation by 40%. That's a double-blind, placebo-controlled study, and that's important. Now, there have been a lot of other studies showing that lemons and limes and grapefruits are extremely beneficial to people who have inflammations in their body or fungus or viruses. I suggested in all my protocols. But now they have this, that the glycoside really does impact inflammation in the body, turns it off. Well, that means dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cystic breast, ovarian cyst, cancers, diabetes, heart disease, all of those have inflammation as a component. So one more reason to have 2 glasses of citrus, the whole citrus each day. And if it's bitter, use some Manuka honey. That'll sweeten it up a bit. And finally, most physicians in Asia withhold life-sustaining treatment for terminally ill patients. Quote from the National University Hospital of Singapore, should doctors administer life-sustaining treatment to patients who are terminally ill? This is a question that raises much ethical debate. Now, a new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine reveals that the majority of physicians in Asia hold back from providing such treatment. More than 70% of 1,400 physicians surveyed said they would hold back life-sustaining treatment, quote, because there's no real chance of recovery of a meaningful life. Now, each of us has a different perspective. Now, I don't believe in holding back any treatment. I believe that I've seen too many people. I've seen tens of thousands of people who would have been given up and died at the hands of orthodoxy, but who were improved or recovered because of alternative therapies. But setting that aside, my own personal conviction and experience, if you're an average person getting the standard medical care and you've been deemed advanced, meaning there's nothing medicine can do, then I could certainly appreciate if the patient decided that they did not want to have any form of therapy. That's their choice, and it is sad, but there's a reality to it. Now, here's the bad part of it. We see most of the very expensive procedures done at the end of life. And it doesn't reverse their disease and it doesn't cure them. It just means that there's a huge amount of medical bills that someone is left to pay, the estate, the person, the family, or part of it, Medicare and other insurance. And we shouldn't have that. So, interesting over there, they have a different philosophy on life. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about issues that make a difference in our lives. And today we have a lot to talk about. In a few moments, a very comprehensive look at the environment, and then my guest, Professor David Ray Griffin, Professor Emeritus. Emeritus means distinguished. former, distinguished, meaning they really contributed something that left a legacy, their stamp on their teachings. We're going to talk about, can civilization survive the fossil fuel crisis and the moral and spiritual issues humans must face for humanity to survive. But first, just want to let you know that we have probably the best special of the year. Here's what we're doing today. We're only doing this once, and there's only because a lot of people will be listening to this on the download. In fact, 99% of the people listen to my program listen on, download it at night. I'm giving a special I've never given before. Here's what it is. It's the red stuff, the capsules. It's it is cranberries, strawberries, apples, cherries, red raspberries, peaches and pears, papaya, mango, watermelon, red currants, nectarines, blood oranges, pomegranates, pineapple, limes, tangerines, apricot, and lecithin. That's it. Nothing more. 4,000 milligrams together in a proprietary blend. This is the super duper red stuff. The two most famous products I've ever invented were green stuff first and then red stuff. And so this gives you so many things that you wouldn't normally in a day consume. I mean, most people might have an apple, yeah, or maybe some strawberries, but you're not going to have cranberries, strawberries, apples, cherries, red raspberries, peaches, pears, papayas, mangoes, watermelon, red currants, nectarines, pink grapefruit, blood oranges, pomegranates, pineapple, lemon, lime, tangerines, and apricots in a day. Not going to happen. Now it can. That means that all the polyphenols and the antioxidants and the special nutrients and the fibers that are in this product now are going to be in your bloodstream, in your cells, in your DNA. Now, I make no claims, but I will state this. If you can find any fruit combination that is better, that will do more for you, and get it, because I don't know any. Now, here's the kicker. This red stuff, capsules, is normally $50. You're going to pay for three $50. I'm giving you two bottles free for purchasing one. Or if you just want to buy one bottle, it's $19.95. We've never had the price this low, ever. So you're getting three bottles of red stuff for the price of one. How about that? $49.95 for three red stuff capsule. Call 877-627-5065 until supplies last. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for your special on red stuff. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
And if I had someone to love me, and if I had someone to really care, I would be best lover.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. In a few moments, our guest, Professor David Ray Griffin from the West Coast, talking about can civilization survive the fossil fuel crisis. right now in Congress, something remarkable is happening. People who are really neocons, the people who support wars and aggression and depleted uranium and bombings, these are the people in charge of the Armed Forces Committee, overseeing our armed forces and the Pentagon, Defense Department. The people who support the intelligence agencies and their evisceration of our constitutional rights and habeas corpus and indefinite detention, they are now ahead of the intelligence oversight committees. But one of the worst of all is Mitch McConnell and others who have been against global warming, meaning they don't believe it exists. And they want to follow the corporate Koch brothers, Fox, Hannity idea that, well, yeah, look, if we had global warming, we wouldn't have all this Arctic cold weather. And look at the snow and look at cold temperatures. And I thought that this is wrong. We need to address this because now these people are in charge and they actually want to have a vote in Congress to determine whether or not climate change is real. But all of them are compromised. They're all affiliated, have received funds with, or politically or ideologically aligned with the polluters, the people causing global warming. So I thought it was appropriate now to give some insights into how bad it is and to possibly give a little better perception that you can't judge global warming by what is happening right now, especially if it's particularly cold, because we think, well, there couldn't be global warming or it wouldn't be this cold. Not true. In fact, just the opposite. Paul Beckwith, a climatology and meteorology professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada, is an engineer and physicist who researches abrupt climate change, what I've been talking about for some time, that we're now in chaos theory. Both historically and in the paleoclimatology records of the deep past and right now today, here's what he says, quote, "It is my view that our climate system is in early stages of abrupt climate change that, unchecked, will lead to a temperature rise of 5 to 6 degrees Celsius within a decade. Obviously, such a large change in the climate system will have unprecedented effects on the health and well-being of every plant and animal on our planet." Well, yes, and according to Dar Jamel, vast amounts of methane lie frozen, as we discuss, in the Arctic. It's not news that the Arctic sea ice is melting rapidly. Everyone knows that. And that it will likely be gone for short periods during the summer, starting this coming summer. Losing that ice means releasing large amounts of previously trapped methane into the atmosphere. Now, here is what we have to understand. Lying along the Arctic subsea continent margins and beneath Arctic permafrost are methane hydrates. They're often described as methane gas surrounded by ice. A report in Science, the magazine, indicated that these cumulatively contain the equivalent of 10,000 gigatons of carbon. Let me put that in perspective. So what's 10,000 gigatons? How about this? Humans have released approximately 1,400 gigatons in total carbon dioxide since 1850. 1850 till now? Wow, we're dealing 165 years, 1,400, and there's 10,000 gigatons trapped? Yes. So Beckwith warns that losing the Arctic sea ice will create a state of, quote, that will represent a very different planet with much higher global average temperature in which snow and ice in the northern hemisphere becomes very rare or even vanishes year-round. In the simplest terms, here's what an ice-free Arctic would mean when it comes to heating the planet. Minus the reflective ice cover of the Arctic waters. Remember I said that one of the problems you have when you have high temperature is you have the sun normally hits the ice and bounces back into the atmosphere, not a problem. But when there's no ice or snow It hits the rock, if it's a mountain, the soil, or the water, and it warms it up. And that melts more. And therefore, there's nothing reflecting it back. So solar radiation will be absorbed. That's not good. It won't be reflected by the Arctic Ocean. That would heat those waters and hence the planet further. And this effect has the potential to change global weather patterns, vary the flow of winds, and even someday possibly alter the position of the jet stream. Polar jet streams are fast-flowing rivers of wind positioned high in the Earth's atmosphere that push cold and warm air masses around, playing a critical role in determining the weather on our planet. What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. Quote from Beckwith, the rapidly warming Arctic relative to the rest of the planet is decreasing the temperature gradient between the Arctic and the equator. What's that mean? It means this decreased gradient is disrupting the jet stream, leaving us to have a warming in the Arctic, forming a runaway feedback loop in which we have the release of more methane in the Arctic. And on land, it's already happening as well. On Siberia's Yamal Peninsula, mysterious holes in the ground drew international attention before they became not so mysterious when Russian researchers found significant amounts of methane inside them. Now that same area is making news again as researchers have found increasing amounts of methane emissions coming from thawed permafrost there. Quote, as the methane concentrations increase in the Arctic from the large warming air rates there in both the atmosphere and the ocean, the jet streams will be greatly disrupted even more than now. Physics dictates that this will continue to increase the frequency and severity of duration of extreme weather events like torrential rains leading to widespread flooding in some regions, but droughts in others. Needless to say, this causes enormous economic loss and poses a severe and grave threat to our global food supply. Thus, the Arctic can be considered the Achilles heel of our climate system. End quote. U.S. Navy researchers have predicted periods of an ice-free Arctic Ocean next year, 1 year from now. British scientist John Nyssen, chairman of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, suggested that if the summer sea ice passes, quote, the point of no return and catastrophic Arctic methane feedbacks kicks in will be in, quote, the instant planetary emergency. Why should we be so concerned about methane when all the talk around climate disruption seems to focus on carbon dioxide? Okay, simple. In the atmosphere, methane is a greenhouse gas that on a relatively short-term timescale is far more destructive than carbon dioxide. When it goes to heating the planet, methane is 2,300% more potent than carbon dioxide per molecule. On a 100-year timescale, and 105 times more potent on a 20-year timescale, and the Arctic permafrost onshore and offshore is packed with the stuff. So according to a study published in Nature Geoscience, twice as much methane as previously thought is being released from the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, a 2-mile square kilometer area off the coast of northern Siberia. The recent study researchers found that at least 17 teragrams, okay, that's 17 million tons of methane, are released into the atmosphere each year, just there, whereas an earlier study found only 7 teragrams heading into the atmosphere. So look how it's increasing. To gain a better understanding of the implications of Arctic warming, just understand a Dr. Jurgenhoff, a senior research scientist at the University of Maryland Physics Department in a joint center of Earth systems technology. His current research expertise is connected with remote sensing of the composition of Arctic methane. And he says, quote, the difference in temperatures between the poles and the equator drives our air currents from the west to the east. If this difference diminishes, the west to the east transport becomes slower and north to south currents become stronger. This results in frequent changes in weather in mid-latitudes. Fast and immediate liberation of methane from hydrates at the very moment, he said, is really bad. increased methane would influence air temperature near the surface. This would accelerate Arctic warming and change the climate everywhere in the world. So this is something that we should understand. So we have a looming specter of abrupt methane release. Natalie Shakova is a research associate professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the International Arctic Research Center, where she focuses on the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. Shakova believes we should be concerned about her group's findings from the SS, specifically because that area differs significantly from methane emissions happening elsewhere around the world. The ESAS is the largest shelf in the world. It encompasses more than 2 million square kilometers, or 8% of the entire world's continental shelf. And Shakova believes it holds an area-weighted contribution to the global hydrate inventory of at least 15% of the whole world. Quote, these emissions are prone to being non-gradual. Now listen carefully what her quote says. This is very important. Massive and abrupt for a variety of reasons. The main reason is that the nature of major processes associated with methane release from subsea permafrost is not gradual, end quote. In lay language, this means that methane releases from decaying frozen hydrates on the ocean floor or in the tundras of Alaska and Siberia could result in emission rates that, quote, could change in order of magnitude in a matter of minutes. Mind you, she's not saying in 100 years or years, she's saying in minutes, and that there would be nothing, quote, smooth, gradual, or controlled about it. We could be looking at non-linear releases of methane in amounts that are difficult to fathom. She explained that the transition from the methane being frozen in the permafrost, either on land or in the shallow northern shores of the eastern Siberian Arctic, quote, is not gradual. When it comes to phase transition, it appears to be a relatively short jump-like transformation from one state of the process to another state. The difference between the two states is like the difference between a closed valve and an open valve. This kind of a release is like the unsealing of an overpressurized pipeline, end quote. Now, these immediate methane releases into this area could be triggered by at any moment by seismic or tectonic events, earthquakes, volcanoes, the subsiding of sediments caused by the hydrate decay or sediment sliding due to permafrost degradation and thawing. And it's prone to these immediate shifts because there's three times shallower than the main depth of the continental shelf of the ocean floor. Quote, this means the probability of dissolved methane to escape from the water column to the atmosphere is from 3 to 10 times greater than anywhere in the world's oceans. In this area, methane is predominantly transported as bubbles. Methane bubbles rise to the surface at a speed from 10 to 40 cmsw, which means that it only takes minutes from the methane to reach the water surface and escape into the atmosphere. Including all factors, Shakova estimates that the carbon pool in this one area, 2 million kilometers, is an order of magnitude greater than 180 gigatons, and that, quote, its role will increase over time. Now, a study published in the prestigious journal Nature confirmed what Shakova has been warning us about for years, that a 50 gigaton burp of methane from thawing Arctic permafrost beneath eastern Siberia is, quote, quote, highly possible at any time. That would be the equivalent of at least 1,000 gigatons of carbon dioxide. Remember, in all of modern times from 1850 till now, 165 years, we've only had 1,400 gigatons. And they're saying we could have 1,000 gigatons, bam, all at once. Even the relatively staid Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has warned of such a scenario. Quote, the possibility of an abrupt climate change and abrupt changes in the Earth's system triggered by climate change with potentially catastrophic consequences cannot be ruled out. Positive feedback from warming may cause the release of carbon and methane from the terrestrial biosphere and oceans, end quote. When the last two centuries, the amount of methane in the atmosphere has increased from 0.7 parts per million to 1.7 parts per million. So the introduction of methane in such quantities in the atmosphere could really send the temperature up 4 to 6 degrees Celsius. It's almost inevitable. So we're looking at major changes coming, and you want to see one? I told you about Greenland, how you have to pay attention to Greenland. Pay careful attention to what's going on in Greenland, because there the global warming is causing some massive changes. And there are rivers now, actual rivers, full force rivers of melting water that no one had paid attention to. And that means that it only increases. So more and more water from the glaciers in Greenland is putting it in there. Now let's just take a look backwards. The Permian mass extinction that occurred 250 million years ago was related to methane. In fact, the gas is thought to be the key to what caused the extinction of approximately 95% of all species on the planet. It was also called the Great Dying. It was triggered by a massive lava flow in an area of Siberia that led to an increase in global temperatures of 6 degrees Celsius. That, in turn, caused the melting of frozen methane deposits under the seas. And released into the atmosphere, it caused temperatures to skyrocket further. All of this occurred over a period of approximately 80,000 years. We are already in the midst of what scientists consider the sixth mass extinction in planetary history, with between 150 and 200 species going extinct every 24 hours, a pace 1,000 times greater than the natural background extinction rate. And this event may already be comparable to or even exceed both the speed and intensity of the Permian mass extinction. The difference is ours is human cause, and it's not going to take 80,000 years. It's happening in nonlinear fashion. So that is of concern to scientists, but it's not concerning our legislators who are now in a position of control. Back in a moment with my guests to take a look at what we're dealing with and what we need to know. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. My guest on the phone right now is Professor David Ray Griffin. I've given you his background already, so let's say hello to him. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Nice to talk to you again.
I want to first touch upon a very recent news item that was posted today in The Hill. That is Senator Mitch McConnell from the hardline GOP neo-fascist caucus wants to have the Senate vote on whether or not climate change is happening. To me, this is just bizarre. So let's step back and think about the lunacy. None of our elected senators are experienced in science, and yet we're going to have bureaucrats with fingers deep into the pockets of private corporations and banks and fossil fuel interests voting on behalf of the entire country whether or not climate change is occurring. Of course, the GOP is eager to push forward the XL pipeline so the Koch brothers can inch closer to taking Bill Gates' ranking as the wealthiest person in the world. However, this case is a clear example of how deep climate change and global warming denialism runs in this country and how out of tune our elected officials are about the fundamentals of science and common sense and a capacity for critical thinking. Your thoughts on this and why it is that denialism that trumps critical thinking and is aligned with the trend of anti-intellectualism that is spreading amongst various sectors of our population.
Yes, it's very complex and very disturbing. But the most disturbing thing is that here we have overwhelming scientific evidence. And what you were just talking about, it is extremely serious, as the subtitle of my book asks, can civilization survive the carbon dioxide crisis? I should have said the carbon dioxide and methane crisis, because the carbon dioxide is releasing the methane, which will be even more destructive. And this is also clear scientifically, but the fossil fuel industries seem to have no concern. I mean, David Koch has fairly young children, and one would think he would care what the world was going to be like for his children and grandchildren, but he seems not to. He's not a stupid man, so it's hard to believe that he just doesn't understand this. But then, he's just one example. The ExxonMobil has been financing this denialism for several decades now and pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into this simply to get richer. And here they are. The CEO from Exxon makes $30 million a year. The Kochs, are multi-billionaires, and they want more money. There's insanity, and so I'm afraid it comes down to that just insanity has overtaken our country.
I want to return to the issue of climate change denialism in a moment, but another news item that touches upon the many themes you outline in detail and unprecedented is that Obama has just announced he plans to regulate companies involved with methane emissions. Only after 6 years in office is Obama finally even acknowledging his dismal climate change legacy. First, share your concerns about the methane threat I just reported on, and how would you characterize Obama's legacy with dealing with climate change and fossil fuel emissions so far?
Yeah, well, it's been very, very mixed, of course, but the mixture has largely been between his rhetoric, which has been often wonderful, and his actions, which have often been very deplorable. And so, as you say, he's had 6 years, and he's done not very much. Now, it was a great thing that he and the Chinese worked out an agreement. And that the agreement should imply that he's giving up his all of the above strategy to, to have fossil fuels as well as clean energy. And I've not seen yet any renunciation of that program. It's nice that he finally, he's acted like an agent for the natural gas company, saying that natural gas is so good and fracking is no real problem. It's nice that he, in his last 2 years here, is trying to create a different legacy. But one would think that we would hope somebody with his sensibilities would be more worried about the survival of the planet for his young children than anything else.
You're familiar with Professor Guy McPherson, right?
I know his work. I don't know him.
Okay, well, he's been a frequent guest on this program, and he holds a very doom and gloom perspective about whether or not humanity can really survive the trajectory we're on. He says we have about 6 to 12 years before we see major disaster to the ability to grow food, massive starvation, and social conflict, because people are going to fight to get food. They're not just going to passively, you know, go someplace and die. So he sees that we're on a very short time schedule. Other people don't want to look at that and say that's nonsense. You seem to also hold the possibility that climate disruption will destroy parts of human civilization as we know it, and therefore it is the most urgent topic humanity faces today. Can you expand further on how serious you perceive the climate change threat today? If nothing changes in policies and the ideology of corporate free market capitalism progresses?
Well, I don't know if I'm as bleak as McPherson, but I'm pretty close. And we just don't know how quickly things are going to develop. And where some people say, well, you know, we've got another 10 or 12 years to turn the corner. But others say, no, we've already turned the corner. It's already we've already got so much carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases in the pipeline already, and that we don't know, and it may all be hopeless now. We just don't know. But I go on the principle that since we don't know, there is a chance that we could survive civilization. So we need to do everything we can to bring down the emissions as quickly as possible. Some people talk about, you know, World War II type mobilization. Well, it has to be much more serious and widespread and fast moving than that. It's possible that we could mobilize very quickly, and it's possible that with very quick mobilization, we might be able to save civilization.
And
so,
how do you believe we should proceed doing that?
The mobilization?
No, the changes that are necessary to make a difference.
Oh, well, switching over to clean energy extremely quickly. The fossil fuel companies have created this impression that, well, you know, clean energy is kind of nice, but it really can't serve. It can't be the only kind. But about clean energy, we have, you know, far more than what is needed. We can electrify the world with clean energy several times over with using the various, you know, there's wind and energy most people know about, but there are other kinds. And you combine all of those, we would have an enormous amount. And we could work very quickly. Many people think, such as Joe Rome, who heads the Climate Progress website, that we could do the whole thing in 20 years, and then we would go negative, meaning we would start bringing carbon dioxide and methane out of the atmosphere.
Oh, well, that's optimistic. I don't feel people need a doctorate in climatology or atmospheric studies to understand the deep crisis humanity faces. In fact, some of the people who best understand and are able to view the data in intricately and holistically are not from the scientific community, but from other disciplines, but are willing to look at all the scientific data intelligently, such as yourself, Naomi Klein, Derek Jensen, and many others. However, people need to make a sincere effort, put aside biases and expectations, even our religious beliefs, in order to undergo a kind of transformation to perceive a clear sense where our civilization addiction to fossil fuels is leading us. So for our final comment, for those listeners who might be just starting that journey, briefly summarize the most urgent findings supporting climate change due to fossil fuels and anthropogenic causes All right.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get your question.
Give us what you consider the single most important rationale and scientific evidence for doing something now, not waiting.
Oh, well, just what you said, that the possibility is that things could develop so quickly if we don't continue. We don't know, even if we go very quickly, that that will make a difference. It may be too late, but we don't know that. So we need to go as quickly as possible, and that means every part of the country needs to mobilize, all the disciplines, all the various kinds of specialties, and likewise around the world. And so we really do need a global mobilization. And one big problem is that they have a whole chapter on the failure of the media. And they are as responsible as the fossil fuel companies for this, because they have simply not informed the people about the seriousness of it. And they've just been glad to take the money and run with that, too. So we have this kind of fanaticism, insanity about money, that somehow making a little more money for my media corporation or for my fossil fuel industry is important enough to risk taking down civilization, for the rest. One fellow who is a very serious scientist, Kevin Anderson, at the Tyndall Center in England, he says if we get up to 4 degrees Celsius, that'll leave us with at most a 500 million people. So very serious people are saying things like this. It's not just people that you could dismiss as kooks.
Well, I appreciate all the good work you've done, including your new book, Unprecedented: Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? And I just want to thank you for your decades of work, especially in the philosophy of religion and the process theology. It makes a big difference, because I believe that the Judeo-Christian congregations and institutions should awaken their worshipers to the ethical responsibility as a kind of global human rights effort to become more proactive in countering climate change denialism and corporatism and politicians who are in denial. So I believe that that is a big segment that has yet to see its mission accomplished. So thank you for doing all that you've done.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you for the interview.
Professor Emeritus David Ray Griffin. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to end out our program today with the type of discussion you just don't hear on television. Panel, let's hear what one of them has to say.
Can you say why America is the greatest country in the world?
Diversity and opportunity.
Lewis?
Freedom and freedom. So let's keep it that way.
Well, why is America
not the greatest country in the world, Professor? That's my answer.
You're saying...
Yes.
Let's talk about...
Fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser. Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of our paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it anytime he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If liberals are so smart, how come they lose? So always.
Hey.
And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom.
The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain,
Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl.
Just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is, there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories. Number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the f*** you're talking about. Yosemite? Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed. We cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. It's like you're reading my mind. Today we're talking about media madness, all the news that fits, they think.
Good. Right now, Utrice Lead.